You're listening to Extra Time Radio.
So, what are you guys going to do? You going to continue to be a bunch of soft, underperforming, tattooed millionaires?
They said all along, perfection is not possible. We just want to get the big decisions right.
What are we doing? What are we doing?
Green room getting hot.
Everybody up here, every single day, goes into the office, into the laboratory, to try to cook up some great stuff for you guys.
The right answer was a goal in Times Square so we could do butts up. But that was an easy one.
That's why he's here!
New York, New York. And on that note, welcome to Extra Time Radio on MLSsoccer.com, driven by Continental. I, of course, am David Goss. Andrew Wiebe is out for the day. He's on baby duty. So Matt Doyle and Bobby Warshaw are joining me for this one. Guys, I'm really excited. When I do the show just with you two, You two are so professional. You're so easy to work with. It's always just a walk in the park. Yeah, Doyle's laughing because it's true.
Are you expecting someone to respond to that?
No, actually, I don't have an ally in this room anymore. I just have you two. There was MLS action this weekend we will discuss. There's a U.S. national team game coming up that we will discuss and preview as well. Canadian national team game, the U.S. women's national team qualifying for the World Cup, and then some coaching rumors, some ownership rumors, different things happening in Major League Soccer. And I am genuinely excited about this show.
Yeah.
Yeah, I felt like I left you. I started you guys off on the wrong foot.
No.
So I wanted to bring that energy.
Okay. Like, let's. I was gonna say, Bobby brings weird energy to the room these days. He really does.
Like,
he's like kind of like a black hole of his own thoughts. Like
why do you say these days?
I mean, honestly, it's a fair point that you're making. I just feel like it's more consistently this.
Listen,
these days
for everyone out there, if you don't know what we're talking about, or if you do know what we're talking about, just go out and buy the book. Where can I get the book?
Your tone right now, like, your tone says you're joking, but there's also, the words hurt. There's like a hint of truth in everything, and I'm going to go home.
Yeah.
And
all right, well, you can figure that out. Do you want to plug your book? Because I gave you a chance.
Oh, thank you.
And you passed it over.
No, listen, I'm not here to plug. I mean, you can buy it on Amazon, but I'm not here to plug.
Perfect. What's it called?
It's called When the Dream Became Reality, but I'm seriously not here to plug.
All right, and let's move on to actual Major League Soccer. Let's start with this weekend's action. LAFC 4-2 win over Houston. 130-minute weather delay in this one. If you watch this game at all, the 3-2-5-2 was outrageous. They were jumping and dancing. The entire section was packed when the game started.
Yes, they're in Los Angeles. It's the first time they've seen rain since 2010.
Max Bredos talked about it for like
2 hours. It was so small personal story. I went to USA Ghana at the 2014 World Cup, and it ended. And as it was ending, it started to rain. And the people next to us were like, the drought is over. And I was like, yes, we beat Ghana. And they were like, no, we're from L.A. It hasn't rained in like 5 months. And I was like, well, I don't think the rain in Natal is really going to help you there. But LAFC went down 1-0 as it started to rain. They basically conceded and then went off the field, took a huge delay, came back to finish the first half. And then the second half, it looked a lot more like what we anticipated it would look like. They ran Houston off the field at times.
I thought they ran them off the field in the first half for the most part. The Monotas goal was totally against the run of play.
Although beautiful from Tomas Martinez.
Yeah, I mean, Monotas had to trip over three people to get there. But they got there, and it was nice from Tomas Martinez, and it's nice to see those moments from him, isn't it?
Yeah.
They've been pretty few this year, even though we had higher expectations. LAFC were good. They played with Benny Failhaber and Lee Wynn behind Carlos Vela, Aaron Kovar to the right, Diego Rossi to the left behind Diamande. And my two big takeaways were Vela and Dio look good. I'll let you take that one because I wrote about it today, but I stole your idea a little bit because you articulated it better.
Okay. And
two, the thing that did concern me, though, is that LAFC struggled to build from the back, right? If they're a passing team through midfield, you play Failhaber and you play Lee Wynn at center mid, there's some expectation you're just going to be a passing team in general. But Danilo Silva specifically was horrible on the ball. Walker Zimmer didn't look that comfortable. Tyler Miller looked rushed. And I'm interested to see, I mean, there's still a lot of questions about LAFC because they're trying something totally new, but can you be a passing team that doesn't play well out of the back?
Yeah, it's a real question, and it's something that I don't think they've had a super great answer for at times. And I can't tell whether it's because the decision-making from Zimmerman and Silva is slow or whether it's because Failhaber and Wynn, who are really, you know, in their early 30s and are learning a new position, both of them, are just slow to get into the spots where they need to be in order to be available for those buildouts. But just from watching the condensed game, it was obvious that they're having some problems with that.
But yeah. Overall, that I started a negative tone. Overall, they were great. I mean, this was as dominant a performance as you will almost ever see in Major League Soccer, right? They were all over Houston. Houston struggled to pass midfield for large chunks of the game, and LAFC was very, very good. And you would have to think that everyone around the West said, oh, crap, to this game.
And so the point I made to you, which you were referencing, was
people have teed that up poorly. I should have started with the other one, then teed you up. I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. People have said that Carlos Vela can't play with Diamande. He had 2 goals, 2 assists. He looked active. He looked energetic. He didn't control the game because that's not the type of quote-unquote number 10 he's going to be for this team. But I felt like he found the game where he was comfortable. And this number 10, central midfield position, whatever you want to call it, gave him the freedom to overload either wing that he preferred to. And then Diamande would drop deep to pick up the ball with his back to goal in moments or connect with someone. And Vela would fill in as the other center forward, which is a position he's played throughout his career. And probably he could play all 3 or 4 positions in MLS at an all-star level.
Vela's positioning this season has been really interesting to me, because when we think about soccer now, generally you put the playmakers wide and have them tuck in, right? A lot of elite teams around the world start their most creative player in a winger position and say, float inside. When Carlos Vela played wide, he was struggling to come find the ball. Like, you generally don't see 10s like Vela play in the 10 spot. Just gets so clogged, right? The 4-2-3-1, 4-3-3 clogs the crap out of that spot. But when Vela was on the right, he couldn't find the ball. It messed up the spacing. And he just is so much better in the middle for that team. But it creates another problem, right? Part of the reason he was on the right is because they could have Atuesta deep, Failhaber and Lee Wynn in a little more natural positions. So to get the most out of Vela means sitting one of the other guys. It means maybe having a little less talent on the right. But, I mean, this team is just so much better when Vela is central.
I thought Kovar played well, but it'd be interesting to see Latif Blessing in that spot. The other thing that I saw in this game was you have to give credit to Diego Rossi, because he dropped back and helped defensively when Vela got caught up the field. Mm-hmm. And he covered a ton of ground in this game. And when Vela came out wide, he gave up that position and would go find the game centrally as well. So I thought that was another promising thing for Bob Bradley. Speaking of Bob Bradley, Taylor Twellman tweeted, so much respect for what Bradley has done in 2018 with LAFC, and yet why do I feel he isn't getting his due the way Atlanta United did in 2017? Honestly, he's done equal, if not a better job with what gives. LAFC, with this win, moved to 56 points on the year. That's one better than Atlanta got all of last year, and of course it ties the 1998 Chicago Fire, who was coached by Bob Bradley. Is he not getting enough credit?
I think he's getting enough credit. I actually saw, I want to give credit a comment on Reddit, of all places, made a really good...
Whoa, don't scoff.
Made a really good point. Like, why is he not getting as much credit? It's the same, and, you know, shout out to Johan Spa on Reddit. The same reason the Red Bulls and Atlanta United aren't getting the same credit for potentially breaking the MLS points record as Toronto did last season. When one team just did it the season before, it doesn't seem as groundbreaking. So I think that's the right way of framing it. What Atlanta United did last year felt almost unprecedented. Now with LAFC doing roughly the same thing, a couple points better even, as you just pointed out, David, it obviously it's not as jarring, and it's not unique. It's distinct, but it's not unique, and there's a real difference there. And I think it has to be understood part and parcel of MLS is a more stratified league now. There are more haves and have-nots, and it doesn't necessarily come down to money. A lot of it comes down to good coaching, and that's what we saw from Atlanta last year. It's what we're seeing from LAFC this year.
Are they similar? I mean, is it fair that we're connecting these two teams besides that they're expansion teams?
No, yeah, it's fair. Of course it's fair. And they are similar, right? They're not just expansion teams. They're ones that want to shoot straight up to the top of the echelon. Like Doyle said, I also want to point out, I always think it's funny. I mean, Taylor does this every now and then, or like big voices do it. I mean, like, people talk about what you tell them to talk about, Taylor. You know? Like, I'm a huge Twellman fan, but I'm like, maybe they would talk about it more if you had talked about it more. You know? It's not just Twellman that does this. A lot of people do this. And I'm like, you are the one that guides the conversation.
Where's...
I have Bob as my coach of the year.
I was about to ask, where is he on that list?
Yeah, I had him as coach of the year.
You don't read every Bobby Warshaw copy?
I open every single one. I got you, Bobby.
Got a lot of tabs. Don't forget about scroll depth. Like, even if you're not going to read it, just scroll all the way down.
Oh, sorry. Doyle's losing dollars over here because I didn't know about scrolling.
Well, A, thank you for that. B, I have him as my coach of the year. But right, it's not just that he took an expansion team to one of the top two or three seeds in the West, but the way they've done it.
Which
right?
is why I was asking, can they be compared? Because the way Atlanta played last year coming in with the players they paid for and the way they played them, is it similar to what Bob Bradley has done?
Yeah. No.
I thought what Atlanta did last year was based more upon high pressing.
That's what I'm saying. Speed and aggression.
Yeah. And, like, it was a distinctly different style of play than what we've seen right. from LAFC.
But they just made a different choice. I mean, they're essentially right. the but same type of franchise now.
But
and
I'm
they
saying,
just have a different style of
as
play.
An expansion team, how much harder is it to play a more intricate and controlling style that Bob Bradley has with a group of players who had never played before? Because that's one of the issues with expansion teams, is, like, you have no base with any group of players or familiarity.
I would have said that Atlanta's system was intricate and difficult. It was just a different way of going about things.
Okay.
Right? With the players that Tata had, he wanted to play that way. And with the player that Bob, and it's also Bob's personality and just who they are as people, I would say it's almost the exact same thing, just used in different ways.
So why wasn't Tata Martino coach of the year last year? Because Greg Vanney won everything.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Couldn't have that been. Was a silly question. I apologize for that one. Let's move on. Colorado Rapids got a 2-0 win at Minnesota, something that does not happen quite a lot. There was a fight at the end of the game. There was two red cards given out, one to Harrison Heath, not Adrian Heath, his son Harrison, and one to Tommy Smith, who started the whole thing by celebrating the
Flexing.
Second goal in front of fans next to the Minnesota bench. I thought the whole thing was ridiculous from him. But
why was it ridiculous? Did you think what he did was wrong?
Yeah. I thought it was wrong, but I don't care that it was wrong. I thought that if you're in second-to-last place against a team you have no rivalry with in a league you're not really from, like, what's your animosity in that moment? It was pure celebration? Then go celebrate with someone else.
Yeah.
I just thought it was unnecessary in that moment with the
you're
way that they played.
Killjoy, man. I thought it was awesome. There's no reason to watch these two teams at this point in the season other than something ridiculous happening, and that's what Tommy Smith gave us.
Well, there was a couple other reasons to watch these two teams in this game. Bobby, did you come away with anything?
Are we going to talk? We're not just going to keep talking about the celebration. I'm down to just do a segment
do
on whether the celebration was inbound.
I would say this. If LJ threw up the LJ and his team was 19 games out of the playoffs in the second to last game of the season, it's not cool. It's cool when he does in the Eastern Conference Finals and throws a dunk down mm-hmm. on Dale Davis's head.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to get
the like Rapids 20-year-old Knicks reference.
Yeah, I didn't even know what you're talking about there. Rapids loons. Okay, the two big takeaways. One, 17-year-old Cole Bassett started for the Rapids. He was the left shuttler in that diamond, but he actually went wide fairly often. Like he went all the way to the touchline, maybe because the middle was too crowded, maybe he was told to. But more importantly, he was really good on the ball, right? And my big takeaway was that he used his brain to solve the problems. He was always thinking ahead. He always had an idea of what he wanted to do before he got the ball. Most young players use their feet to solve problems, right? They get the ball, then they think, but they're talented. I mean, they were signed to 17-year-old. They must be really dope. So they try and dribble out of it, and it's too late at the professional level. It was really nice to see a 17-year-old who clearly was always thinking ahead, but is also good on the ball. Like, I'm a big believer. I say it often in the show. You show me the way a player receives a tough pass, and I'll tell you if he's good at soccer or if he's going to be good at soccer. And some players, they get happy feet. They just get nervous, their body language. And Cole Bassett just looked chill, man. He looked comfortable getting those passes. I think that translates well to his future.
I'm happy to see that. I'm a big advocate for play your kids. He couldn't hardly have been any worse than a lot of the guys that, that Colorado have run out all season. They came into this game, 7-game losing streak, having been outscored 22-1. He was good in his 90 minutes in a 2-0 win on the road against a team that had been pretty successful at home up until this result.
It
so
helped
it's
that Angelo Rodriguez went offside for no reason twice in this game.
Yeah, he's not really performing like a DP, is he?
No, and it was really bad.
The second thing from that game was that the Rapids looked really good. The Rapids looked amazing in this game.
Oof.
And
did I watch a different game?
Let's not oversell this, Bobby.
You didn't think they looked awesome?
You didn't feel like that Boley goal came out of nowhere?
There was a 25-30-minute stretch at the end of the first half. From like 20, maybe after Quintero's header miss, right point blank, that I thought the Rapids totally bossed the game. That they had almost all the possession. They pinned Minnesota back. and they played really well, right? Maybe I'm maybe I just had such a low bar that my mind took it as exceptional. But the reason I bring this up is that if you think about the teams that are going to miss the playoffs, how many of them have an identity or a plan, right? Maybe it's, you can rule Toronto out, but the rest, it's like, what are they trying? Like, what are they playing for? What are they progressing toward? And when I watch the Rapids, even when they lose, it feels like they're trying to do something. And this game validates the struggles they've had lately for Anthony Hudson, because he says, silly, look, if it works, if we do what I'm telling them to do in training and they execute, we can be really good. And I think that actually means something for Rapids fans. If I'm a Rapids fan, I probably feel better than I do the other teams that haven't made the playoffs.
Wow. Bobby, bringing a lot of sunshine to Colorado Rapids fans on this Monday afternoon.
Jack Price looks a lot like Kyle Beckerman 5 years ago. He's not he's not as good on the ball. He's not quite the passer at the base of that diamond, but the way they move, the way they read the game, their pass selection, Jack Price is 1 and 2 touch all over the field, and he's mostly clean.
Okay, Bobby Warshaw sold on the Rapids. You do have to say,
I'm not sold on the Rapids.
I know.
I have more optimism, right? They need a professional level center back.
Yeah. Right? I would say, when you talk about like the teams missing the playoffs and what do they have, Kellen Acosta, Jack Price, and maybe Cole Bassett as pieces in central midfield.
Edgar Castillo and Marlon Harrison.
We don't know that.
He's going to be back.
Castillo's back.
Of course. Marlon, if you told me that they go into next season with Harrison and Castillo at outside back, a decent Tim Howard in goal, right? That's another conversation that they've really, it's an elephant in the room they need to face. But then Jack Price, Kellen Acosta, and Dylan Serna, actually, as well. Mm-hmm. I really like him as one of those two players in that midfield. But if you put a professional, you know, striker and a professional center back on that team,
yeah, well,
I'd buy stock.
We'll see what happens. I'm pretty sure everyone's buying stock right now in DC United, a 1-0 win over FC Dallas, a late Russell Knauss goal to win it, his first career MLS goal. And Doyle, you've talked a lot about what he's done for this team this year, stepping in. This wasn't like a, oh, he's so good, but he was, first of all, super calm. He hit the underside of the crossbar in the first attempt, and then he got his nose not broken but bloodied scoring the actual goal. It was a good moment for a young player who's had a good
run. That volley
run
would have been a spectacular goal, and like just following it up the way he did. This is a game that DC, I think, should have won in the first 5 minutes when Wayne Rooney was through on goal and had a look that he blew. And they kind of didn't emotionally recover from that.
That was probably the only good chance until this one.
Yeah, well, they had one later on as well that, again, fell to Rooney and I think was blocked. But it was, look, this is 2 weeks in a row now that they've gone out there and they haven't played great soccer and they've ended up getting victories. And beating, like, Dallas isn't great, man. They're 6-5-4 since the middle of the season. It's fine. But they remain,
although they were on a 6-game unbeaten streak, but I guess
what I was going to say is that they remain a tough team to beat. Mm-hmm. They're not a great team, but they're a tough team to beat. And for DC to beat a team like that in a game like this where they weren't particularly sharp and they were missing Paul Ariola, and condolences to him and his family for their loss, I think it says a lot about what this DC team has become. They're a frightening team to think about entering the postseason. I do wonder, though, if they're going to spend it all, spend everything they have just in the hunt to get, now they're above the playoff line, and claim that over the final three games and make it into the playoffs. Like, if there will be a letdown after that, the way there was in 2016.
I'm glad you brought it. It was nice to see DC win to give Paul Ariola that moment and to do it for him, and to have Russell Knauss and his family history score the goal was special. For DC, they did not look great this game. It was a big win over the top team in the Western Conference, but it wasn't convincing. And I say that because last week over Chicago at home was not convincing either. And those are the two games since Montreal. And I think we look at what made DC so good for that stretch since Rooney arrived. It was their ability. There's two things, really. The ability to move the ball, to move defenses, to create opportunities, and then winning the ball back when they lost it, and being animals in the middle of the field, getting the ball back in good spots. In order to do that, you need to play simple passes and simple short passes, right? And I think in the last two games, they've gone away from that. And it's a natural progression in my mind, because what do you do when you do a simple thing well? You try and do the harder thing, right? You try and improve. You try and get better. It's a natural human thing. But on the soccer field, if I've done the simple thing of making that 5-yard pass to the guy, I know I can do it, and we know we can win that way. Maybe instead of making that 5-yard pass, I fake that 5-yard pass. I play across my hips to the through ball, right? But that doesn't come off, and all of a sudden we don't have the ball. We haven't moved the defense. And it just feels like DC United now, since they were doing the simple thing so well, everyone on that team was like, you know, maybe I'll just try the next thing. But the next thing doesn't make them a better team. So right now the possession's a little slower, a little more static. They're not really manipulating defenses around. And when I watch games, it just feels like every time they get the ball in the middle of their final third, they're just looking up to make the hard pass, and it just takes an extra second or two, and that is, you know, a big difference.
How much of that do we attribute to O'Neal Fisher getting hurt? Because he was kind of an unsung hero.
So I was going to throw this out there, yes, but also Nick DeLeon came off the bench.
He did.
And helped at that right back spot in place of Jalen Robinson. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't want
to. Which was infuriating because I had Robinson on my fantasy team, and I would have won my game if not for those.
Robinson is yeah, sort of like,
you know, Ben Olsen checks your lineup
if
every
this
week.
Was, if this was 20 years ago, Robinson would be a no doubt about it right back. But in the modern game where you need your fullbacks to get forward and provide with, which O'Neal Fisher was doing really effectively the month and a half before he got hurt, he's not quite up to that level. And Areola has played some right back and been really good at it. Of course, the last 20 minutes last week against Chicago, it was the move with Zoltan Stieber coming in to play left midfield, that allowed Areola to get forward because there was or right midfield, there was allowed Areola to get forward more because Stieber's such a good passer of the ball. So they didn't quite have that with Robinson. They brought it in with Nick DeLeon. But the point I'm making is that Rooney and Acosta and even Canales, to a certain degree, have taken so much of the air in terms of the discussion of how DC United have had the second half resurgence, and they have deserved it because they've all three of them have been remarkable. But a team is a machine, and you need all the parts functioning, and just having that one almost tertiary part in terms of O'Neal Fisher not there making those same overlapping runs with the same timing has made it just a little bit more complicated through midfield and made those gaps get a little bit smaller because the ball's moving a little bit slower, and 2% less efficient doesn't seem like a lot, but it's a difference between a team scoring 3 goals a game and a team, you know, getting a 1-0 win at home as your defensive midfielder breaks his face to try to push that ball over the line.
I get what you're saying. I think it's more of A leading to B opposed to Fisher being B causing them to be slower, but I mean that Fisher's absence has played a role.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the other side of this for a second, though, because FC Dallas loses this game at DC United, which isn't a bad result, and there's nothing wrong with that. But then you look at LAFC getting the win the night before, and now all of a sudden the top of the Western Conference is tight. So FC Dallas is 1 point ahead of LAFC, 4 points ahead of Sporting Kansas City, but Sporting Kansas City still has a game in hand. That one will be played midweek this week, and we're going to talk about that in a second against Vancouver. To close out the season, Sporting KC plays at FC Dallas and then home to LAFC.
Yeah.
When you look at these three teams and you look at their path, you know, is it good that SKC now controls their own destiny because they play them head-to-head, or would you rather be FC Dallas playing Colorado in the last week?
I think I would, at this point, I would still rather be FC Dallas. Like I said, they haven't been playing great. 6-5-4 over the, you know, the last 15 games doesn't really wow me or anyone, but they're a tough team to beat. They have the Sporting game at home, and then they go to Colorado. Unlike Bobby, I don't think Colorado's the best team in MLS because of 90 good minutes at Minnesota. I don't think Cole Bassett is about to win the Ballon d'Or.
If Cole Bassett gets a man of the match performance and they beat FC Dallas in the last week.
Did Matt Doyle just give me a hard time for saying something nice about a young domestic player?
Yeah, because he doesn't believe that if given the opportunity that they can get it done. So Darrell doesn't believe in young players. Let me give the rundown. FC Dallas hosts SKC next weekend. They then go to Colorado to finish out. LAFC hosts Vancouver next weekend on short rest but fighting for a playoff spot. Then they head to SKC to close out the year, and SKC has at Vancouver midweek, at FC Dallas on the weekend, and then the following week they host LAFC. Who's the favorite to win the West?
I think at this point, I think it's still FC Dallas, because they have that SKC game at home. Mm-hmm. You expect them to win that and then go to Colorado in the final week of the season. And granted, Colorado Rapids are 1970 Brazil. You know, they are one of the two or three greatest teams ever to play soccer. But you would expect Dallas to take care of business against a team like that. I think they...
If SKC didn't have a game at Vancouver this weekend, would you still favor FC Dallas to win at home against SKC right now?
I think so.
Really?
Yeah.
You don't have any belief in Kansas City is what
I do.
I'm figuring out.
I do have belief in Kansas City, but I'm not sure I have enough. You know, they're what, 2-2-2 in their last six. They had a chance in their last two games at home to really run away with it, and they somehow managed to draw against RSL and then managed to draw again against the Galaxy, and they did not get friendly officiating in that last Galaxy game, but it happens.
Peter Vermees both got fined and told he was correct on that one.
Yeah, hopefully they won't come for me. But like, look, they play at Vancouver, which is not going to be easy. Then they play at FC Dallas on short rest, which is not going to be easy. I think that's too hard for this Sporting KC team right now.
So maybe even the bigger conversation is who gets second, right? Because third place, you have to go into a first-round playoff game, which no one wants to see. LAFC, their close, home against Vancouver. It's probably going to come down to them at SKC.
On the final day.
Yeah, on the final day. How do you see those two teams head-to-head?
Oh, I was ready to talk about Dallas for a second.
Oh, then do that.
I was just going to talk about how this game against DC.
Bobby, I just want you to be happy.
Thanks, man. I want to talk about this game against DC and how it really does epitomize, I don't know the right word for it. It's an example of who FC Dallas are, right? Because they had chances to win this game, right? This game went to script for them. They won the ball. They went on the break. Michael Barrios got chances. Maxi Rudy could pick up his head and find players.
So could Michael Barrios, by the way.
And they just didn't execute, right? And I think that's what has to scare the crap out of Oscar Pereira. He picked these guys, right? He plays Maxi Urruti at the number 10. He could have moved Urruti back to number 9.
Yeah.
I mean, he played Barrios at number 9 out of position to keep Urruti in that 9.5-10 spot, right? He wants these guys on the field because they fit his system. They work hard. They're competitive. They're good in the break. They're fast. And they can just run hard at goal. But they don't have a ton of quality. Right, so how do you set up this system that is meant to get players certain types of chances, but they don't have the quality to finish those chances? And this game, I mean, Oscar Pereira has to feel great about the way his players played. They just didn't score the ball. And that has to keep Oscar Pereira up at night because it all went to plan, and yet they lost.
The only team that they've scored an open play goal against in the past month and a half is Orlando City, who are currently possessors of the worst defensive team in MLS history title, though the Quakes might come thundering through and steal that back from them soon. They don't score the ball. Barrios does a lot of work. Rudy does a ton of work. They fit Oscar Pereja's style. The final touch is not there often enough for
the final decision.
The final decision.
This one was frustrating in that Barrios takes a shot from the top of the box, which was their best chance of the game. Just slide the ball to the right and find a team. You're on a 2-on-3. Like, you have open teammates, and Urruti did the same two separate times.
Roland Lamont was straight in on goal. That was like Joseph Martinez and Barco stuff.
Yeah.
Like, what is going on in your lives that you didn't pass him on the breakaway?
Yeah.
Like, I need to know what happened there.
Let's talk about this week for a second, though, because SKC does head to Vancouver. That one's going to kick off 10 p.m. Eastern time on Wednesday night. Vancouver, if they win at home Wednesday night against SKC, they jump into the sixth playoff spot. They jump over the LA Galaxy into a tie with RSL, and then everyone's even on games. Do you see any life in this Vancouver team? I mean, this matchup hosting SKC, Doyle, like, is this an opportunity for them?
It's absolutely an opportunity, and they've played some fun soccer throughout the season, but you just never know with their central defense. Their central defense has fallen apart this year. I mean, they've conceded 60 goals after last year, I think, being one of the better center back pairings in the league. Kendall Waston hasn't quite been the same guy, and that's hurt, and they've not been able to replace Tim Parker at all, and that's hurt, and left back has been kind of a revolving door, and that's hurt. And when you have that, you have a really inconsistent up and down year. But I maintain when they have Davies on one wing and Teixeira on the other, and Jordi Reyna and Kai Kamara together up top, they've been a hell of a lot of fun to watch. They, and especially against a team like Sporting Kansas City, and we know they're not the same pressing team that they were last year, even, or especially 5 years ago, but they still will occasionally, they'll leave you gaps to counterattack into. This is a pretty fun matchup for Vancouver, and I mean, if they get the result here, they have a chance. They absolutely have a chance.
They probably need it, because then they go on the road to LAFC on Sunday, and then they come home and play the Portland Timbers, who may not be in a must-win there, but they're a team fighting for playoff spots. So there's not a lot of opportunities here for Vancouver to pick up points. That's a huge one on Wednesday night. The other big one is DC United hosting Toronto FC on Wednesday night, 7:30 p.m. Eastern time. That one on TSN2 up in Canada. DC, you said it, they haven't played great. They've been getting the results. Now they bring in a TFC team that had some pieces go away for international, but has started to get healthy and has played better over the last few weeks.
Well, TFC is going to be without Oso, Jonathan Osorio, because we'll play with Canada the day before. Right. Michael Bradley is still with the U.S. team. Whoever
Victor
knows,
Vasquez
just got knee surgery.
And he's done for the year.
Who knows what's going on with Jovinko and Josie these days and their bodies and
all
that. Well,
Jovinko's with Italy as well.
Oh, Jovinko's with Italy. It's exactly right. Yeah. So is this still the same Toronto team? I mean, no. This is at this point, if you look at that lineup, is actually a 10th place team.
So let me ask you this. Ben Olsen, because of the way the schedule is, now that he's in the playoffs, quote-unquote, they're not clinched, do you think he rotates this team any differently?
Rooney gave a quote after the last game talking about how important this next game was. He said, we really need, if we get a result, then we can separate ourselves. So going off that quote from Rooney, I would be surprised if they rotate.
You think they put their eggs in this basket, which is they'd be 4 points up on Montreal for the final playoff spot.
You have to. Even though their next game is at home against the NYCFC team that's been really terrible the second half of the season, you have to play the game in front of you, especially against a wounded animal of a TFC team. The last thing you want to do at this point is take your foot off the gas.
And DC is strangely deep, even without having to rotate Rooney and Acosta, right? They'll probably start Nick DeLeon at right back. Mm-hmm. Paul Ariel is unclear if he's going to come back. They can switch between Stieber on the wing and maybe Stieber. I guess he's probably coming from international duty. If they could play Maddox out there, they can play multiple guys defensive. If they can bring in Harks for Durkin.
Maddox also with Jamaica.
Oh, then I don't know anything.
Yeah.
Maybe at right wing.
They are thin up top right now. It's pretty much just Rooney.
But either way, my point is they can rotate the defensive midfielder, the right back, and the center back and still have a solid team. So you can get some rotation without taking out the main guys.
Yeah.
The other game on Wednesday is Orlando hosting Seattle. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Orlando for a second. They lost 2-0 to the New England Revolution, who were eliminated from the playoffs 20 minutes before they kicked off on Saturday night after DC United won. So then they went out and played pretty well. They also played Orlando, so that helps. You mentioned it. Orlando has given up 70 goals this year, which breaks the record for the worst defense in MLS, which was created last year by Minnesota United.
Yep. So it no longer feels unique or...
I mean, you're basic at that point.
Yeah. I mean,
say something to Orlando fans for me. I don't even know what to ask.
It was really bad when Jason Christ got fired, and it's somehow gotten worse. If you look back, it's now 21 games. Like, they had that 6-game winning streak, and we were like, some of this is fool's gold. It's you're still gappy at the back. You're getting these, you know, unrepeatable last minute, heroic performances. Do not bank on winning a lot of games like this. And then they had that 9-game losing streak, and I think we all thought, see, this is the bottom falling out. This is what we were warning about. But now they'll have some sort of structure and play with some cohesiveness, and find their way maybe towards respectability. Not all the way there, but towards respectability. And
where Doyle lives. It's like right around where Doyle lives.
What happened to Lamine Asane? I mean, we talked so much when he came into this league as like, this is a Bundesliga starter.
Yeah.
That guy's not been very good.
He's been actively poor. I don't know. I don't know. I'm like, I didn't see a ton of, like, I had seen some of him when he played in the Bundesliga and Ligue 1, and like, he was fine. He wasn't outstanding in any way. He could be beat at times, getting pulled to the ball and a little bit of ball watching. But, like, the ball moves really fast in the Bundesliga. That happens to good defenders. Some guys aren't just cut out to be elite at that level. But you should be able to take Bundesliga defender who's just fine and plug him into MLS and have him be pretty good.
If not just fine.
Yeah.
Which would have been an upgrade over what he's done.
And he has not been anything close to just fine. Like, if you look at the way this roster was constructed, it should be fine. Like, they should, like, Lamina Sané and Jonathan Spector should be fine. Carlos Azquez should be fine. Ori Russell, okay, like, maybe the league has evolved too much over the last 5 years for him to have kept up. Like, maybe he wasn't the right guy. Like, obviously, he wasn't the right guy to choose as an everyday defensive midfielder in this league. But Christian Higuita should be fine. Yoshiyu Tun, who's been one of the better players for Peru, should be fine. Sasha Kljestan should be fine. And none of them are fine. None of them. The only person, the only player on this roster who has been in the realm of what's expected is Dom Dwyer. He's gone out there. He's scored about a goal every other game. He's put in some hard work defensively and in, like, showing for the ball. And that's it. The rest of them, like, literally every person on the roster has under-delivered what should be expected of them. And, it didn't work under Jason Kreis, and it's worked even worse under James O'Connor.
Let's move to the other side. Exit interview time. The New England Revolution were eliminated. Their exit interview. We asked if your team has one coming up, unfortunately, potentially. Send us your questions. Mike from South Carolina here. I'm here for the exit interview for the Revs. Please tell us, Revs fans, how we should feel about this season. Do you think Friedl has a long-term plan? Did the Revs meet expectations this season or not quite? Should we riot? Should we stay calm? I need a neutral perspective. Bobby, talk to them.
Yeah, mission accomplished for the Revs in 2018. I know that sounds crazy, but if you thought you guys were making the playoffs with a new coach and your roster as constructed, it was optimistic, right? The best thing that could come out of this year was Brad Friedl making it Brad Friedl's team and a culture that he wants. And can we question that this is Brad Friedl's team, the way he handled Lee Wynn, the way he handled Kellen Rowe? I mean, it is his way or the highway around there. And yeah, they haven't really set a style or the soccer hasn't been pretty. But when you take over a team, the first thing you want to do is build a culture and a philosophy that you believe in. And it feels like Brad Friedl has done that. It is his locker room.
I mean, I can't actually. It's a really well-framed rhetorical argument that Bobby just made. So then the question, because it is Brad Friedel's team, it is his way or the highway. The question then becomes, is his way valuable or sustainable? Does his way have any merit? And from what I've seen of the Revs so far this year, they don't care about passing the ball at all, but they're playing arguably their best passer, Kellen Rowe, at left back. Like, why would you play a guy whose only value above replacement at that position is his passing ability? Why would you play him there if you don't really care about passing the ball? Like, it's some, like, Bobby's right from a big picture view. Like, okay, you want some sort of reboot. That's what Brad Friedel's given you. But the internal functioning of that reboot, the machinery, does not seem to make any sense to me. I would be very nervous if I was a Revs fan. I would be very, very nervous if I, and especially because, look, Teal Bunbury had, I think it was 18 goals in 34 games. He's had like one or two in the past dozen since then. And once he dried up, there was no other plan. There was no other plan for this team.
And the most concerning part about where they're going, even though I do think it was mission accomplished, was probably the player recruitment. That, okay, it's Friedel's team, right? He gets to do what he wants. They're going to listen to him. But, Christian Pena has been a good signing, but the other, what, seven or eight this year have all been bad. Not just average, but straight up bad. And that's concerning, right? Because it's his first time coaching, really is a professional coach, and in MLS at this level, does he understand how to recruit the right kind of players? So while I think it was a good year for Brad Friedel, I am a little worried if I'm a Revs fan.
One goal in 13 for Teal Bunbury, by the way.
So anyway. And I think if you're a Revs fan, that's what you're going to see right now. Is it wasn't an up-and-down year where, yeah, we're not great. We win some games. We lose some games. It was a straight shot up, and then basically the rest of the season was a fall-off. And so if I told you in February this is where the Revs finish, you know, two spots out of the playoffs on X points, you say mission accomplished. But when you see it as the way the season flowed, does it hurt that they're coming off, they have such a bad taste in their mouth to end the season?
I would say if you had told me they could be 2 or 3 points out of the playoffs and come down to the last, you know, two games, I would say, yeah, the Revs should take that in a heartbeat. Plus the fact that Brad Friedel has made his statement makes this as a successful year for that organization.
Of course. But now what I'm saying is they didn't win a game for 3 months.
Oh, does that
it's
sour?
Not, we're not in the same place anymore, right? Because of the way it went.
You're right. Does the way it happened change it? My answer is no, but I don't have a...
To me, it does. Because, if the way that they came out of the gates proved to not be sustainable, and if it's not sustainable and the signings aren't generally speaking, aren't good, then you have to question whether the Brad Friedel approach is a worthwhile approach to take.
Yeah, you're right.
And that puts the whole project into question.
One. Yes, my answer is yes.
Last piece for the Revs. I said Orlando hosting Seattle on Wednesday. New England heads to RSL on Thursday night, 9 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN+, DAZN, wherever you can find it. RSL isn't going to play on decision day. So they have this game, and they've got a game this weekend coming up to try and put themselves in a place to make everyone else catch them in the playoff race on that final weekend. I think, one, your question should be, if you're a Vancouver LA Galaxy fan, what type of team are the Revs going to travel across the country and bring? And then also, how do they match up with RSL?
Go ahead, Ben.
We've been having these conversations since the beginning of time, right? It comes down to the end of the season. It really happens in all sports, right? Do you get lucky? Do you get unlucky? It's even true in the World Cup, right? If your third group game is against a team that's already qualified. So, yeah, I mean, it's unfortunate for some of these teams, but that's the way the world works.
Yeah. I mean, I expect that the Revs will bring whatever they have that they consider their A team to this game. Because given the way that Friedel has managed this roster, I'm sure he has said to these guys, you're all playing for your jobs. And maybe that lights a fire. I don't expect, like, one thing that Friedel has done well is he has made these guys play scared. Play, you know, like, Revs players tend to not take games off from what I've seen. And that's something to build on, and I'm sure that's what they'll bring. But to me, this is much more about RSL. How does RSL deal without Kyle Beckerman and Sonny? Demir Krylock's going to be in central midfield. I think Albert Rusnak is going to be in central midfield. I don't know who their actual defensive midfielder is.
Nick Beasler?
I was going to ask that, too.
But he's been their first-choice center back.
Yeah, they just signed that dude for Unwaha, a reason.
Yeah. So, like, maybe you move Beasler up, but you're going into a must-win game at home, starting a central midfield pairing who's literally never played together.
Although you're
before.
Playing against a team that doesn't really control possession and create out of central
midfield.
Oh, they
did against Orlando City. Yeah, no, you're right. Right. You're right, but, like,
Scotty Caldwell, baby. Scotty.
But, like, central midfield isn't just about generating possession that leads to goal scoring chances. It's also about your balance in terms of knowing how to play through a press, understanding how to position yourself defensively to stop a counterattack, where to be to win second balls when your back line is being put under pressure, and you have to be in the right spot for clearances, which they abjectly failed at against Portland a week and a half ago. So, like, I would be beside myself, nervous, not able to sleep if I was an RSL fan these next couple of days.
For the Revs, they don't play this weekend, so they have the whole week off into decision day. So that will probably affect the way Brad Friedel travels and plays this team. Let's get one final on-field MLS note, and then we'll talk off-field. Last Friday, Veljko Panovic speaking to our Sam Stachel, and he said, do I think I'll be back, speaking about next season? I don't know. I don't see the future that way. I cannot see those things, but I'm confident that I will, he told Sam.
I mean, it's a little bit of prevarication.
Yeah, but he has no contract, and I think we started to get in places, maybe in our circle, where it was assumed that he was just going to leave.
Yeah.
So that's interesting to hear.
He's had 3 years, and he's missed the playoffs by a mile in two of them. And what Chicago did last year proved to not be repeatable this year. And roster is a year older, and I would say not better. And not obviously that a lot of that falls on Nelson Rodriguez's shoulders. If there are questions asked about Veljko Panovic's future, there should be some asked about Nelson Rodriguez as well. I'm surprised he's so confident, to be honest with you. I can't.
Whose side? So, sorry. I'm surprised he wants to come back. You're surprised that he thinks he's going to get asked, like, that the Fire want him back.
Yeah.
Oh, so we're seeing this from the opposite sides.
Like, what leverage would he have if he wanted to leave? Like, he's not the coach who won the 2015 Youth World Cup anymore.
No, but
he's a guy who had two pretty bad years in MLS.
But what are the Fire offering free agent coach?
I mean, that's fair. But, like, there are only 24 top flight jobs in MLS available. Like, I'm sure if you called Caleb Porter or Mark Dos Santos or Robin Fraser or, move on down the list.
I don't think any of those three would take the job.
I think so.
Maybe Mark Dos Santos. I don't think Caleb Porter would take this Chicago Fire job. And I don't know if Robin Fraser would leave. That I might be wrong about that one. That's fair. But, like,
Let me ask you this.
They played a college soccer team with Bastian Schweinsteiger for half the year.
let me ask you this. What do the Chicago Fire do well?
What do you mean, as a team?
Yeah.
Veljko Panovic moves college soccer players around a lot to try and squeeze one more drop of juice out of them.
I think that. Okay.
I don't think the roster's been good this year for him to perform with.
It hasn't.
They were over the playoff line in July.
It hasn't. But he's also a head coach who plays. I mean, he's playing Bastian Schweinsteiger as a center back.
Agreed.
And again, some of that falls on Nelson Rodriguez. He should have brought in some more quality center backs at some point. But some of it is also Veljko Panovic. You got to figure out how to get more from Jonathan Campbell. You got to figure out how to get more from the guys who are already in the team. Like Matt Polster is a really good player. I think he's a really good right back. He is not so good that your season should fall apart without him 2 years in a row.
And Jaumira.
But like your season shouldn't have ended when Matt Polster got hurt.
Yeah.
And it kind of felt like it did. Yeah. Like
which was after the first game of the year.
Right? I'm not sure. I honestly don't see what Veljko Panovic has brought to the table after 3 years. And I'm surprised that he's as confident that he's going to be back as he is.
Interesting. I didn't see it the way that Doyle did. That's why we do this show. Mm-hmm. You always learn something from each other. That's all we have to talk about on the field. Of course, you can go to MLSsoccer.com, check out all those midweek games, and then a huge weekend of action coming up all on Sunday, 3 p.m. and 5 p.m. Eastern time. Every team in the Eastern Conference will play, and every team in the Western Conference, except for the Revs, will play at the same time. Let's go off the field, though, for a second, because there was some big rumblings that broke up that came out on Friday and some big news. Nothing final, but MLS released a statement about the Columbus Crew SC ownership situation, and in it they said Major League Soccer and the Columbus Partnership have been working together for several months on a plan to keep Crew SC in Columbus. We have made significant progress. Recently, the Haslam family, along with Columbus-based Edwards family, have joined the effort to keep Crew SC in Columbus. The Haslam family, current owners of the Cleveland Browns, the Edwards family, a local family ownership group. They then released a statement saying that they are working on a plan to acquire franchise rights from Major League Soccer of a Columbus Crew SC team, and that Precourt Sports Venture would use their MLS rights to move a new franchise to Austin. It's news.
It all sounds like good news. It also sounds like it's not done yet. I will just reiterate my stance from a year ago when all this broke. I'm a Hartford Whalers fan. I was a Hartford Whalers fan from the moment I was born. I will be one till the moment I die. I know exactly the type of suffering Crew fans have gone through this past year, and I am overjoyed that it seems like they won't have to live with the pain of watching their team leave for another city. I saw this all start coming out on Friday morning, and I stayed glued to Twitter and Reddit and everything else, texting friends who are in Ohio and just trying to get as much of a scoop as I could. It was a spectacular day, and I hope that I hope that the powers that be are able to push this over the finish line, because I think it would be great for those fans. I would love to see more Hell is Real derbies as well, with Cincinnati coming in next year. So, fingers crossed for everyone to, dot every I and cross every T.
And as you said, this is ongoing. That's why there is no definitive statement to be made, but it sounds like talks have been happening for a little while, and it seems like these two groups have the potential moving forward to have some good news come out of it.
And credit to everyone around Columbus for all the hard work they put in, right? There were a lot of people that worked really hard to get to this moment. You're right, it's not done, but to have gotten to this moment, just credit and a thank you, I think, from a lot of people, that those people put in so much hard work and so much diligence with the Save the Crew movement.
Yeah, and the end of the MLS statement said, MLS is committed to keeping Crew SC in Columbus should we continue to make progress on these critical components and agree to key terms with the investor group. That group put out a statement, as I said, we are excited to jointly announce that the Columbus partnership, along with local investor group led by Pete Edwards Jr. and D and Jimmy Haslam, have formed an alliance to continue the collaboration with Major League Soccer to keep the Crew in Columbus. We are optimistic about our recent conversations with MLS regarding the potential sale of the operating rights of the Crew, of the Columbus Crew. While there are many details to be worked out, our alliance is working diligently and collaborative with the league to keep the Crew in its community. So we will wait to see this ongoing story. We will, of course, continue to cover it on MLSsoccer.com and here on Extra Time Radio. But it was good to hear some news finally, and we'll see how it continues to progress over the next few months. We've got U.S. national team coming up in the second segment. We've got Ben Bear coming in here. I'm ready for him to roll on in.
And I'm seeing a tweet from Sam Stachel right now saying that sounds like João Plata, Jefferson Severino, and Albert Rusnak actually probably won't be available to start on Wednesday because they're all getting back from international duty late.
So you would think that this is one of those moments, maybe Rusnak's different because they could be competitive, where RSL would have tried to push a little and say, hey. I guess João Plata hasn't been a consistent Ecuador player, so he wants that opportunity, and Severino hasn't broken in fully to Venezuela.
I was just saying, from a scheduling perspective, if they could have seen this a couple weeks ago, knowing like New England doesn't play this weekend, but they play next weekend, was there a way to move these games around to ensure that two teams who were out of it had this Wednesday, and then all the teams competitive were the two Sundays?
I mean, you've already sold the tickets, and
of course,
and you already have the game locked in. So we'll see what happens. But this is also part of soccer, is you have internationals to mm-hmm. deal with. You have to have a deep roster. You have to have different things to be able to get into the MLS playoffs. Coming up, U.S. national team. We'll talk about all those national team games.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com or tweet at extratime radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Baby, tell me where your love lies. Waste a day and spend the night underneath the sunrise. Show me where your love lies.
Welcome back to Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental and MLSsoccer.com. We've got national teams to talk about. We covered all your MLS in the first segment. U.S. national team will face Peru in Connecticut, the home of Matt Doyle, mm-hmm. probably the most famous person. Who's the second most famous person from the state?
I don't even know.
So I have a really depressing conversation someone had with me one time about the best athletes in Connecticut history. Uh-huh. And, like, Bobby Valentine and Chris Humphreys were, like, on the top of that list.
Yeah.
Is that an accurate? I thought someone was, like, missing a huge name.
I mean,
Kyle Martino?
Kyle Martino.
I'm going to say Marcus Tracy, number one.
And Marcus Tracy was awesome. Okay. But, no, Connecticut doesn't.
You don't produce athletes.
We produced, like, a lot of, like, pretty good basketball players in the 60s and 70s. And
nice.
Then there was a women's softball pitcher who struck out Ted Williams on three pitches from Waterbury, Connecticut.
Oh, yeah, that was awesome to watch, actually.
Yeah, whose name?
What are you talking about? How old were you
when
this happened?
Maybe they just redid that where there was A-Rod. I think someone struck out A-Rod a few years ago. Not Ted Williams. Sorry, carry on.
But they're like they're.
I just want to know how old Bobby
they're,
was.
Like, Connecticut hasn't had a whole lot.
That's not what
of,
you do.
Of great, I mean, there is George Springer from Hard Hit in New Britain, soon to be back-to-back World Series champion.
I don't know what is even happening right now. Okay, so on
Joe
that
Joyce
one,
was the softball player. I was thinking
on that one, the U.S. 7:30 p.m. Eastern time on ESPN2 and UDN. They face off against Peru, coming off the 4-2 loss against Colombia. Last set of national team camps, they lost to Brazil, followed that one up with a win against Mexico. Daryl, what do you want to say?
I guess Katharine Hepburn is probably the most famous person from Connecticut in modern times. And overall, Benedict Arnold.
I thought you were going to say Katherine Hegel, who also is from Connecticut.
I don't know who that is.
Stop. You guys are going to allow office talk, and we're not going to talk about Grays?
I don't know what Grays is.
Oh my god!
My girlfriend watches every episode.
Are we talking about soccer?
We could talk about the U.S. national team at some point. If
I heard they're playing in Connecticut.
If we can ever get everyone around.
I had fun the second half against Colombia. I had fun the second half against Mexico. Anthony Robinson took a beating against Brazil, and then when he came on against Mexico 4 days later, he was really good. Maybe we'll see something like that again. Maybe we'll see more progress from the young players. Everything we said before the Colombia game stands up in that it's a bummer that we're seeing these two games without Adams, McKennie, and Pulisic, who are probably the three best talents on the team. But as long as I get to see more young players in high leverage spots and we get like a real control study in terms of understanding whether they have something to offer at this level, I'm happy. Like, this is some sort of progress, and we haven't had methodology to what we're actually doing since 2011.
What does fun mean? Break down fun for me.
So the bar has moved, right? Like, 10 years ago, if this was Bob Bradley's national team, when we were, you know, a good team that had just won the 2007 U.S. Open or Gold Cup. And we're trying to progress towards being a team that could compete at the top of the world's game, which we literally were in 2009, this wouldn't have been enough for me. But fun for me right now is clear the slate, tabula rasa. Let's get our young players in spots where they're best. Let's see if there are partnerships forming. Let's see if they can occasionally do something good and productive in attack. And let's see, again, methodology. Let's see something that we learned from game A applied in game B. And I don't think we had that under Klinsmann at all.
So you don't think that style matters? It's just the feeling that we are...
I didn't say that.
Yes, you did. You just said that you feel like the biggest thing for you is like we're systematically making progress.
Yeah, I said the biggest thing, but not the only thing. Style matters as well. Like, if we were going out there in a 5-4-1 and, like, locking it down and playing, like, Costa Rica circa 2014, like, I would take some enjoyment out of that.
Wow, Costa Rica just got knocked in
this
whole
conversation.
They were an
ugly team, man. They played ugly soccer.
That's our World Cup quarterfinal.
I know.
We didn't even qualify.
And that's why I'm
tournament.
Saying I would take some enjoyment out of that. I'm not sure how much fun I would be having.
Which is interesting to take from this whole experience, right? Because in 2009, when we were U.S. men's national team addicts, right? It felt like it was at the best trajectory it's probably ever been at. A big part of the appeal was a feeling of progress, that we did have the sense like, yeah, we actually are going to win the dang World Cup. And it might not be pretty now, but we're going that way and we're going the right direction. And the head coach is building this foundation that we're going to build on for years and years. And I'm with Matt. That idea of progress and a plan is addicting. I thought in 2009, and I feel now, that for soccer to grow in this country, it has to look a certain way. That as long as we play regressive, as long as we sit deep, as long as we counterattack, and Bob Bradley got too much stick for being a counterattacking coach. That lineup he put out was often way more attacking than he got credit for. But I still think if we want U.S. men's national team and soccer in this country to really get to the next level, the national team needs to play a certain way. And we need to understand that. We need to acknowledge, we haven't talked about this enough with the head coach, with the progress, that one of the things we actually really do need to do, and it's even harder. It's one thing to win. It's one thing to get results. And it's even harder to do that while playing a certain way. But I do think, to build on what Matt says, the next evolution of soccer in this country demands a national team play.
So you've made this point, and you kind of just made it again, Doyle. And I'm going to agree with Doyle here. Is like, we're in a place where guys didn't play in their best position and we couldn't win in Trinidad and Tobago. I can understand that part of our progression is what you're saying, Bobby, but the next one isn't. The next one is becoming a competent team again.
I'm actually concerned that it is, and that it always has been, and now the job is just harder because we also have to do the base level,
yeah,
right, and have a plan and get people to believe. But to truly get everyone's faith back and to grow the game the way we want to grow the game, it has to look a certain way.
So would you say that, like, if this team started playing like the Apex Bradley team, which was late 2008 right up until that, you know, the Charlie Davies accident, which was set a little bit deeper, not exactly a low block, but lower than a mid block, certainly, and kill teams on the counter, would that be it, or does it need to look different from that?
I've been trying to pick my brain about this. What percentage of games do you think we actually did sit deep and hit teams on the counter? To answer your question, yes, I do think it needs to be more than that. Okay. I think we actually remember the Bob Bradley era wrong for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Bobby, stop saying we. You could say I sometimes.
Sorry, you're right. I do, and I think it's true about the larger culture, American soccer culture.
That's fair.
And that, but yes, I think the answer is yes, Matt. I do think that for soccer to go to the next level in this country, we do need to have a fast, exciting, you know, attacking style.
Was not what those teams played under Bradley fast, exciting attacking?
You mean counterattack in soccer history?
Yeah, you just said they sat deep and waited. It felt like we, in American sports, we need to
sounds
be the best.
Like, it sounds like what you're saying is we need to have a passing style.
Passing or pressing, yes.
What are the other?
One that feels like, maybe the best way to verbalize this, one that feels like we're the better team on the field. In American sports, MLB, NBA, NFL, NHL, we're the best league in the world, and we're still combating that in soccer. And it feels like if we do want to pull fans in, that we need to give that illusion that, not the illusion, but just the feeling, our national team's on the field, we're the better team, at least we're even, and we're not playing the style that is played by the team that isn't as good.
Interesting. It will be interesting if the U.S. goes out and is successful with a pressing system to watch mainstream American media understand what is occurring. Because a pressing system, you don't dominate the ball. But you dominate chances, maybe, but you don't dominate the ball.
The feel of the game.
Okay, that's fair, but maybe not to everyone who doesn't watch soccer.
But the thing is, when you watch the game, it looks even because your players are on that end of the field, and the ball's down there, and there's more duels, and the game's faster, right?
Right.
Whereas when you're sitting deep and countering, you're just in your end, and the other team has the ball more. Just the general feel is one, as Matt says often, when a team sits deep, it's less exciting. I mean, maybe if you're really good at countering, it's fun, but games with pressing are just more they make it feel like the game is more even, but they're also just faster and more fun to watch.
I want to move on and talk about Canada for a second because I want to talk about hope, and there's a lot of hope there. But first, I want to pull you guys back in. Taylor from Ithaca. Bradley was excellent tonight, last Thursday. The problem isn't and never was him. Anyone who claims he's been no good for the USMNT is either blind or ignorant.
It's too...
What are you, blind or ignorant?
Both, I guess. Look, he was really good through 70 minutes. He was really bad for the last 20. I don't think he was – I think he was unfairly maligned throughout much of really the last two cycles. If you look back at, like, who was good in the 2018 cycle, other than Pulisic, nobody. And like, maybe Bradley should – as the captain, maybe he should have been better than he was and lifted the guys around him. I guess you can criticize him for that. I certainly don't blame him for the Trinidad and Tobago loss.
For the island, he was – they sent him to Tobago instead of Trinidad
right,
by himself.
He was playing 1v4 in the midfield. But, like, everybody shares some blame. Everybody shares some blame in what happened last cycle. And I'm a big Michael Bradley fan, but I bet he would be the first person to tell you, yeah, I share some blame in that.
Let's move on to Canada, though. They host Dominica on Tuesday night, 7 p.m. at BMO Field. Their first home game under John Herdman, their first Nations League qualifier at home. They won their first qualifier 8-0 against the U.S. Virgin Islands in Bradenton, so that's a pretty good cushion to go off of here for the second of what will be four qualifiers. Last time they played Dominica at home in 2015, they beat them 4-0. They should stop playing Dominica so often, but right now they got to get themselves higher up in this Nations League. Doyle, this is a very young team, although they do have some veterans. What type of lineup do you want to see John Herdman put out there?
I as with the U.S., I do want to see young players, but obviously this is a game that matters, so you have to put your best lineup on the field. So I'm sure we'll see some of Atiba Hutchinson, some of Junior Hoilett. I'm excited for that front line, though, whether it's, you know, Kyle Larin with Alphonso Davies and Balu Tabla, and there's the kid Johnny David from Ghent as well, and, you know, Lucas Cavallini. He's not quite as young, but he's just 25, and he's been really good in Liga MX.
Don't
Liam
forget Alphonso
Miller.
Davies.
Yeah, I did say him.
Oh, okay.
I didn't forget him.
I wouldn't mind seeing Alphonso. You just mentioned all the attacking talent they have. I wouldn't mind seeing Davies play center midfield or maybe just off the striker, something different, right? See if they can.
Something like what Vela played for LAFC.
Yeah. Or, I mean, there's a point, it felt like around the last Gold Cup, when we thought if he'd be a super dominant box-to-box center midfielder, that maybe he didn't quite have the skill or the quality in the final third. He's shown that to be wrong, right? But there's a brief point when we looked at how he was developing, we said maybe he's just one of these guys, you know, that just dominates the entire field. And I wouldn't mind seeing Canada in a game against this type of opponent try Davies somewhere new.
I mean, I would say it for a friendly, but I understand the impulse for sure.
So then you look at midfield for this team. Atiba Hutchinson, it sounds like this is going to be a swan song. Mm-hmm. He hasn't always come back to play for this team. Canada hasn't really had direction or competitive games for him to be a part of over the last few years. And we've talked about it a little bit, but I think it's really depressing that he should have been in the conversation for best player and especially best central midfielder in CONCACAF over the last few years. And it's been ignored because he's basically not had a relevant national team to be a part of. Does he get this start, though? He's saying 2019 Gold Cup's his finale. Does he get a start alongside a lot of these young guys?
I don't see why not. But, you know, at this point in Herdman's career, in his, you know, guiding the national team, you kind of leave it to the coach to decide, and you see if there is structure, like if there is a foundation being built for the next 8 or 10 months, and hopefully Atiba Hutchinson will be a part of that, and hopefully he'll go out on a high note, you know, next summer and have a Gold Cup performance similar to what he had in 2007. You know, maybe this time he'll be able to stay onside because he was clearly offside in 2007.
You know, it's been tough for Canada over the last few years. It's good to know how sympathetic Doyle is about the way this national team has gone. There's a lot of promise. There's a lot of hope in this team for Canada. It's going to be exciting to watch them play. So if you're in the Toronto area, get out and go to that game. And then last little piece, U.S. women's national team qualified for the World Cup. It was a tight 6-0 win over Jamaica in the CONCACAF Women's Championship. That was the semifinal. They will face Canada on Wednesday night in the final, but both of them have already qualified. Does that bring you any joy there?
They've been dominant, right? Tobin Heath,
I think
Megan
it was 6-0, 5-0, 6-0.
Yeah, and the front three, those two with Alex Morgan, have been great. I'm personally incredibly excited for Lindsay Horan. I think she's the best center midfielder I've seen come through that program. I'm still a little concerned that they're not a little better at passing the ball, right? They're winning the game much the same way they've won a lot of the games throughout the last, you know, 20 years, where individual brilliance, power, going forward really quickly. I would still like to see them move the ball because, you know, individual brilliance isn't quite as easy to do against France and Germany and some of the better teams in the world. But, you know, they've done what's been asked of them. And to go back to what Doyle said, they're really fun to watch, right? Rapinoe and Heath at their best are extraordinary to watch on a soccer ball.
By fun.
Well, before we have that conversation, we can do that one off air. Let's let everyone take a little break for a second. We're going to come back with the mailbag. We've got Ben Bear coming in here on Extra Time Radio.
Fans, we want to hear from you. You're encouraged to email extratime at mlssoccer.com. or tweet at Extra Time Radio with any comments, questions, or reactions.
Yeah, yeah. And don't you ever go, don't you ever go, darling, cause you're all that I know, you're all that I know. Why did you change your mind?
Back now on Extra Time Radio, driven by Continental, MLSsoccer.com. The Green Room has one more fellow soccer lover, Ben Bear. Thanks for joining us.
Very glad to be here. You know, had the week off last week. Come back roaring. Big week this week.
I saw a video of a bear that had a bucket on its head for over a month in, like, Pennsylvania, and they cut it off, and he was all over the place. I reminded me of you.
That sounds familiar. That's how I'm going to play tonight. Nice. In our rec league game.
You guys were out of subs, so Ben has to go a full 90 tonight.
Wow. Are you going to
rope
Bobby?
And by full 90 means like full 50.
45 minutes?
I mean, I'm going to try and make it the whole time, but odds are Goss is going to get a red card at some point.
Nah. Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to be playing down a man. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to be going full 50, then us down a man as well.
I imagine you guys are pretty terrible if Goss isn't out on the field, because from what I've seen of your rec league team, David is
here
the only one.
Here comes a backhanded compliment.
No, David is
the only
one.
We're missing like
defense.
Our three best players again.
No, that's
week.
Not true.
Who else defends?
There's a player on our team named Susan who's the best defender
on our
team.
She wasn't.
No, she's on vacation. She's
okay, so yeah, you're
we're missing her, our Figo, our class midfielder, and our forward. So.
Yeah, but you're still a number 10, right?
No, I play on the wing now.
Ben missed an XG of
yeah,
1.0.
Yeah, it was 0.95 last week.
And he's been moved officially now from that position. Speaking of which, this has nothing to do with that. Mark Machado from Winchester, Virginia. Guys, in my opinion, Steve Birnbaum has been back to or near his best. He has been very solid and composed since the middle of August, early September. If he maintains this form heading into the playoffs and in the playoffs potentially, does he deserve another chance with the U.S. national team?
I wouldn't hate to see him in January. He certainly has a lot of the profile that you look for in a center back, but a couple of good months is not enough to write off what happened over the past year and a half, where he was asked to lead that DC United back line, and he really wasn't able to do it. I think a lot of his form can be attributable to Russell Knauss being in the lineup. Now, that's not to say, I would be totally fine seeing Steve Birnbaum in January camp, but he's not in my top 8 or 9 or so central defenders that I'm looking forward to seeing for the U.S. national team.
Yeah, he should be given the opportunity to have his career grow. He'll go to January camp. He'll get a shot in that atmosphere or in that sphere.
But hasn't he already done that?
He has.
Yeah,
but it's totally conceivable that he's better at age 27 than he was at 24 or 25.
As of right now, he should not be one of those top 4 or 5, but he should be given the opportunity to prove that he might get into there.
Yeah, one of the big things with him that people have talked about is partnerships. Like, he needed Bobby Boswell. Is there someone in the U.S. that he would partner well with? The national team pool.
That's tough to say right now. Because
what is the national team pool of center backs.
Yeah. I think
we have guys that we throw out there.
We all agree at this point that Brooks and Miazga are numbers 1 and 2.
Yeah, I don't think he fits with either of those players.
As talented as Brooks is, he hasn't yet distinguished himself as a leader, as someone who comes out there every game and gives you the same level of performance and intensity, regardless of who he's paired with or who it's against. So I think we talk a lot about partnerships, but there's more to it than that. And like, I think with Steve Birnbaum, because of his club form, that has to be a question.
I just think, to me, yes, he's maybe playing better. Maybe just he's kind of getting messed over because you're scoring more goals. You have Wayne Rooney. You have all of that. And so you're not really looking at your defense to lead you. You're looking at Wayne Rooney and Lucho Acosta to lead you. So it's not as much on his back anymore. I just think, for me, with the national team with him, it's a question of upside. And what is Steve Birnbaum can be serviceable. He can be fine. Maybe, you know, he can be fine in CONCACAF. Is he really going to go out there in a World Cup in 2022 and be out there and be successful? The odds of that, I think, are pretty low at this point. But then you look at all of our young center backs like Trusty and Glad and all those guys have some much higher upside and potential in those situations. So you might as well give them the shot to grow into that, as opposed to a guy who you may not even. It's also like you're not. He's not a reliable. You're not going to get the same thing every single time from him either. It's not Chad Marshall, so he could have a bad game against Trinidad or whatever like that. So what's really the objective if you're going to put him in the national team? I just don't see it right now.
Ben Bear says no. I take that. No chance for me then because of Ben Bear. I appreciate that. I also want to point out that Chad Marshall had 12 caps in his career, which is wild. A lot of that was like injury issues and bad timing and stuff like that, but it did happen. David in Witham, I don't know where that is.
Would Colorado, Katie Witham?
I don't think that's a place.
Oh, okay,
Would Colorado be as bad as they are if they had not bought Tim Howard? Seems like that was the moment they went from looking really good to a continuous slide down.
No.
I mean, he's the one who led them to the Western Conference Championship.
Did he, though? Weren't they already a competitive team?
They were competitive because he came mid-year in
July.
Yeah, so he was not a significant upgrade or downgrade from Zach McMath that season. He was fine in 2016. He has not been great since then, obviously, by any stretch, but I don't think he's been the heart of their problems. To me, the heart of their problems is that the three guys that they spent a lot of money on this offseason, Wilson, Tommy Smith, and Jack Price, two center backs and a defensive midfielder, none of them can defend.
Jack Price is good. You should have thrown Joe Mason in there instead of Jack Price. I'm serious. Jack Price is good.
No, we know that. So, I always forget, Zach Mamath was really good that year, but who knows if that would have continued on for the last half of the season.
Yeah, or you could say it's indicative of what happened. And he was good in the playoffs.
And
you could also say it's indicative of what happened, where they placed McMath with a higher price Howard, and they replaced Courtney Ford and Axel Schuberg and all these guys with all the guys you said, which is what ended up happening. The Toronto Duck, you talk about how MLS is improving. Would a team of current players beat a team of all ex-players in their primes?
Oh,
Bobby,
wow.
Come on.
Let's go. What are the teams?
Right? Give me an MLS 11 from 2005. Is that a good year to pick?
No. But
what year would you pick
for like the best year in terms of the most talent?
I guess you could say that. But here's the thing.
I think you go like early MLS, like 96 to 01. So you have like that group.
But you have to take them when they're in MLS.
Yeah.
You're not
that
saying
group,
like,
and then you have like 02 to 2010.
Mm-hmm.
That's another group of players.
11
and then
to
you
15.
Have 11 to 15, and then you those are the three teams.
And then you have the
and then you have today's.
You guys build me. I need four 11 starting 11s right now on the spot.
This is what we talked about before the drove, Gus.
Do you have any strong feelings on this one? Seriously, Bobby.
The biggest difference between Major League Soccer now and 5 years ago, 10 years ago, is the coaching. The coaches are way better now, right? If you look at the coaches who were in charge in 2010, tactics wasn't really a word that they used, and style and system and identity, right? The best coaches, I mean, Jason Kreis put together the best team of that generation, but he, as we found out, is not really a tactics guy. He runs good sessions. He was able to manage that group. But I think if you were to take any of the coaches now and the well-defined systems that they put together, they would beat those teams. So maybe the players have gotten a little bit better, but the biggest marginal difference has been the quality in coaching.
I think
Bobby's 100% correct.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Bobby's 100% correct.
Davi Ferreira was MVP in 2010?
Yeah.
You think you'd be – what do you think Davi Ferreira's skill level is, and how would that translate to
today's MLS? I think he'd still be an excellent number 10 in this league. Absolutely.
I would like to say that someone described
him. Is he better
him.
Or worse than Kaku?
Maybe slightly better. Maybe slightly better. And, like, Marco Echeverri would still be –
No, I'm saying – I think that team would do well against this team, the early team.
Like, so the I think the point I would make is that the high-level players have pretty much always been there, other than maybe, like, 03 to 08 or so. The high-level players have always been there. I think if you go – down the roster, MLS now was much better than it was 5 years ago, much better than it was 5 years before that, much better than it was 10 years before that. But Bobby was 100% correct. The biggest difference between MLS in 2018 and 2013 is coaching. The biggest difference between MLS and 2008 in 2018 and 2008 is coaching. Teams are just tactically so much more sophisticated now. They understand how to manage a game better now. It's not just all about run fast, try hard, get stuck in.
Except for sometimes.
Except for sometimes.
It's all about run fast, try hard, and get stuck in still. As an end-of-the-year award, can ETR give someone the Haters Gonna Hate Award? For the player who proved all the haters wrong, my first nomination is Wayne Rooney, as many scrutinized his signing. And he's catalyzed the team, certainly, into the playoffs. This is from Bearded Jack. He said last year's winner would have been Bradley and or Josie. He also said he wanted to keep the message short, but an honorable mention to Bobby picking Philly because he's won the Haters Gonna Hate Award.
This is so ridiculous.
I don't like the
We're
judge.
Still going with this?
I don't like to judge human beings on how much money they make. You're entitled to have problems if you make a lot of money. But if you make $7 million a year, you cannot also have a chip on your shoulder award. Right. Let's just acknowledge that, you know.
Me personally, Bork Deutschkal gets it because he came in for six
well,
weeks.
Well, someone judged him really harsh when he came in. Some other people were like, let's see how good he is. I don't know. Maybe he'll be good. But other people decided to just It's immediately say
it's
he's
Doyle's MO.
And then Doyle's going to come back next week and go, I thought Doyle was so brave in stepping up last week and stating
so.
Dogecoin.
I think so, yeah. I think that guy was – well, look, the point I was making
it's
is Jossie
Zardes for the record.
Yeah, league-wide, it's almost certainly Jossie Zardes. The one of us actually made a guarantee at the start of the season that Jossie Zardes would end up with more goals than Ola Kamara. This guy right here, two thumbs. But I think the point cool. I was making about Deutschkoll is that players like him get brought in and get given two straight months of starts to find their feet and find their rhythm and to be productive. And then after settling in, okay, sometimes they're productive, other times not. I still think as a league we have to do better about giving that kind of rope, that kind of leeway to homegrown players, to domestic products. We just don't do it, especially with attacking domestic products. And I'll say this. Name me one homegrown player over the last 2 years who's been given 10 straight starts and who has failed.
I just want to point out, first of all, why do they get more leeway? Because they've proven that they can do it at that level, right? Young players haven't proven that. You're taking a leap of faith, really having no idea if it will ever
Danny
materialize.
Wilson and Tommy Smith have not proven that. They've proven they could do it at other levels. But here they are, 34 games in the season, still starting.
If you're an above-average championship player...
You don't know. Do you know that they were above-average championship players?
No, I don't.
How many championship games did you watch?
But presumably the Rapids felt that they were, right? Then you can also believe that they would come here and be an above it. But that's why, in theory, that's why they give the older veterans more of a leeway. Because you know that you're pushing towards something that
you can trust. I understand the theory, but it's time to examine the theory and figure out what parts of it are worth keeping and what parts aren't. And I'll say again, name to me one homegrown player over the last 2 years who's been given 10 straight starts, 8 straight starts, and who at the end of it has failed.
Harry Shipp.
The Sounders were unbeaten in their last like 11 games that Harry Shipp started.
I just wanted to say Harry Shipp to see if I could
come
get
on,
you.
Can't.
I mean, that's not really – time out. That's like not really an argument.
He was given – like he earned, I should say, the starting role. In Seattle.
No, Rodriguez got hurt.
People got hurt.
Yeah, and he earned the right to be next in line.
Buono was hurt.
Yeah, he also started playing the same time that Ozzie got back and Ladero got back.
And they got Rui Diaz.
And Rui Diaz arrived.
Did he fail?
He's also about it because he's not.
Okay,
he's also not really a home.
He's not a
category,
young player
right?
anymore. Yeah.
I would guess there's less than 5 homegrowns and who in their first 2 years professionally got more than 10 starts in a row. I would guess that there's 5 that even done it, period.
I'm not saying in their first 2 years professionally. I'm saying in the last 2 years. I'm saying name me domestic homegrown products who have been given that kind of rope and who have actually failed in this league.
Well, how many have been given that much rope?
That's the point!
Yeah, oh, no, that, your point, point. No, your point is it failed. Which
no,
is he, also
his point is that homegrowns, when they're given a shot, don't fail. Generally.
But they're not given a shot. That's
they're
why
never
it's
given
so
a
hard
shot.
To... Right.
You can't even do this.
So, in the middle of this, does anyone else want to name a hater's going to hate?
It is Jossie Zardes. So it doesn't matter.
Sure.
Oh, really?
We're talking about. We're locked in on Jossie. Yeah. Are you locked in on that, Bobby? Mm-hmm. No one else has like anyone good.
I mean, if
Jossie was
Galaxy,
right back last year.
Yeah. If the Galaxy make it to the playoffs, then like the Galaxy win the team award.
Okay,
because everybody was having so much fun when the Galaxy was terrible.
Tom, a trombonist in the South Ward, wants to say this. I was listening to Extra Time after a week filled with constant self-criticism regarding my own career and life, and Bobby's comments on players' mentality going really sank in with me well and gave me a lot of really good perspective. I know it's not related in industry, but it made me realize just how much I do think of my career and choices and shortcomings as life or death when they clearly haven't been for years I've been alive so far, and why people who have been doing it much longer than me tell me I'm doing all right, even when it feels like I'm not. Music's definitely more forgiving than a professional sports contract, but even so, the perspective helped me stop and breathe for a minute. Thanks, Bobby. Never underestimate when you guys help people in small ways.
Wow.
Hey, thank Michael Bradley for letting that guy run right by him, you know? I didn't do anything here. I just... point out. But thanks. That's really nice. No, that really means a lot. I really appreciate that note.
And by the way, the South Ward brass section been on point the last couple of years. They have not Houston level. The Dynamo still have the best brass section in the league, but I like what I'm hearing.
What did you play for them?
Cornet.
You played the cornet?
Cornet.
Wow.
I do love that. The Rebels, like the Rebels Twitter fan base has like hates Doyle.
Yeah, they don't.
And he doesn't. And he was a supporter the first 15
years. Yeah, but
years
Doyle only went for the
MetroStar supporter.
You also only went for the glory days when it was like 6,000 in an 81,000 person giant stadium. You only care about flash, no substance. Eric Erickson, final here, says, Dave, thanks for mentioning the argument that Pam Beasley is the worst on air. She's my favorite character in The Office. But it was an interesting read. He went out and read the articles. I went out and read the articles, too.
That article is not worthy of discussion.
I'm not as convinced as I thought I was going to be by all of these pieces. But I'll agree that she's not that great. And then one final one that said, oh, I also want to throw out props to Doyle for throwing out some unnoticed Spinal Tap references during the show. I myself am old and dorky enough to appreciate them. Sir Jade.
Smell the glove, man.
I've only seen it once, so I can't get the right.
Don't get into it, dude, because Alexi Lawless is going to hit you up, but he's going to get mad, and then it becomes a whole thing on your Twitter notifications for a while. It is funny that Doyle's basically doing his own podcast, and we just don't 100%. Even know
it. Everything I say is just a reference for Gen Xers.
No, I get some of those. But I'm all here for Office takes. Yes, Pam Beasley. Doesn't always make great decisions. Doesn't always come off as the best person.
Yeah.
But, like, just look at the totality of her character.
Do you think Jim Halpert's a terrible person?
No.
Jim Halpert's definitely a terrible
person. I don't think he handled that in the right way.
No, he was just mean. He bullied Dwight for, like, 12 years.
I mean, did Dwight deserve it?
Whoa. Okay. Wow. Well, as Ben descends down this.
I mean, there's a lot of things in The Office that happened that wouldn't be cool in today's.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you all for joining me. Everything that happened today was super
cool. We're sending Ben to HR right now.
I really enjoyed this. Thanks, Doyle. Thanks, Ben. Thanks, Bobby. And Andrew Wiebe will be back with us on Thursday, week 33 coming up.
Week 34.
Week 34.
Okay, the week before Decision Day coming up, and it's one of the biggest weekends of Major League Soccer. It's going to be really fun, right, Ben?
Yeah, we got three games on Wednesday, too, and the game on Thursday.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Don't forget to set your fantasy lineups.
Yeah. Who won our Fantasy Periscope podcast tomorrow.
Ben, who won this week? What? We went head-to-head. Who won?
Nobody, because nobody wins.
This is actually a phenomenal story. Doyle had won originally. Opta redid the stats. All of a sudden, they were tied this morning. What happens when you're tied is it goes down to point differential from the regular season, and Doyle beat Ben by 1 point in the regular season.
Wow.
So Matt,
this is like a Red Bull Atlanta United situation.
They can't hold us back, man.
Ben lost off the Kaku penalty kick save 3 weeks ago.
That's actually probably.
That's amazing. Is that really what
probably,
it is?
Probably true.
Oh, my God. And on that note, everyone, have a good week. We'll be right back.